88% of our respondents told us that they felt there was a limit on the number of times they could ask a member of their community for information. And most of the time when they felt constrained, the reason was that they didn't want to put themselves in a position where they looked uninformed or weak.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Most of us have been in a situation in which we could ask a question, but we don't in case other people judge us. This can have serious consequences if asking questions is how you find out about important things in your life, like how to organise your finances, the best way to farm your crops, or decisions that you have to make about your health. Ben Golub of Harvard is one of a team of researchers who have investigated why a group of villagers in rural India may be reluctant to ask for advice and what that costs them and what we could do about it. Welcome, Ben.
Hello, Tim.
Your work focused on villagers in Karnataka, India. How important is this social learning for them? How does it happen?
So let me back up a tiny bit and say what we mean by learning, because of course it can be very specific to context. So In that situation, the issues that we asked about are how people get information about health, their work, which is usually farming, and financial services or products they might use. So maybe a new clinic or a way to get a bigger yield on your farm. And we find, maybe unsurprisingly, that social learning of some kind is universally important. So 95% of people we asked report that they hear important things about issues like that from friends, even without asking. And then on top of that, about half of people report actually going out and seeking information actively on these issues when they need to make a decision. So if you're trying to think about a new farm techniques that you might use, you go out and ask your friends if they've had any experience with that or something similar. And so we think, you know, both based on our intuition and also these questions, we think informally learning is a huge part of how people get very important information about their lives.
Yes, I said most of us at the beginning have been in that situation where we could ask, but we don't. You did a survey of these farmers at the start of your research. Did it suggest that this stigma effect is universal?
We felt from our own experiences that it was probably out there and pretty important. We've all felt, I think, you know, shy to raise one's hand in class or something because, you know, even if we thought that nobody else understood either, but you might look foolish. But my collaborator, Arun Chandrasekhar at Stanford, does field research all the time, and he's laser focused on always testing our intuitions with the actual people whose lives we're interested in understanding better. And so his first step was just go out and run this survey and talk to people. And that's where we got all these numbers I've been saying. So 88% of our respondents told us that they felt there was a limit on the number of times they could ask a member of their community for information. And most of the time when they felt constrained, the reason was that they didn't want to put themselves in a position where they looked uninformed or weak. So they sort of were willing to share with us that that indeed was a part of the reason.
Now, I've called it a stigma. I note that your research splits this into two components. What are these two components? How are they different?
That's a great question. So there are really two things. And the first is what economists call signaling, which is fundamentally about reputation. So say I want my peer or my next door neighbor to think I'm good with money. If I ask a question that reveals I don't know something basic about finances, she might decide that, in fact, I don't know much. And then I might get fewer opportunities or just less status in the future because, you know, I'm not thought well of. And that's really all about keeping my reputation good, right? There's another aspect, which is even if an advisor already knows I'm bad with money, it might simply make me feel bad for that to come up again, to be salient in our conversation. So I'm just ashamed of it. Even if it doesn't really affect anything in the future, I don't like being in that position right now. It's kind of emotionally unpleasant on its own, even irrespective of reputational issues. And that's the part that we call shame.
I see. So the rough difference, if I understand it properly, is that we would expect signaling to matter more when we don't know the person very well. But if we do know that person, then shame comes into it more.
That's a very natural interpretation. And there's simply a lot more room for reputation management to play a role when the advisor is someone who doesn't already know a lot about me. And of course, that's even more true, actually, if the person is in a position of some kind of importance or power to me where they control access to opportunities or have a recommendation that I might value that they could give to someone. I think the real difference is that if someone does know me very well, there's simply not much room for signaling of basic attributes like intelligence or responsibility to play much of a role. And so to the extent that people resist asking, even in those cases, we think that probably wouldn't be about signaling. And that, with those close connections, that's where shame comes into the picture.
If you're testing for these, then it occurs to me that there's a problem. Both signaling and shame produce the same inhibition. You don't ask. So how can you design an experiment that's going to distinguish between these two types of inhibition?
Yeah, that's really the whole kind of intellectual challenge of this experiment. So the basic idea is that we first created an experiment where people could sometimes use someone's help to make a good decision. And in our main treatments, the people who did better on a kind of standardized test that we gave them had better information on their own. And so they ended up needing other people's help less. So that created a pretty natural source of signaling. I don't want to ask you because if I do go out and ask you, you think I need help. And the reason I probably need help is because I did badly on the test. That's why I'm seeking kind of extra advice or clues. And that's sort of capturing the real world phenomenon that someone who's not so good at reading the farming literature or listening to the agronomy radio broadcast is going to be the person who's just going to ask someone else to tell them the right thing to do.
Yeah.
But now, as you say, how do we disentangle whether I'm not asking you because I'm worried about signaling that kind of ignorance or because I'm simply ashamed? And so we found a way to turn off signaling and just focus on shame. And here's how we did that.
Mm-hmm.
Say you're my advisor and we're interested in whether it's signaling or shame inhibitions that are mattering for me when I'm not asking you. Well, one thing we can do is we can turn off signaling by just saying, hey, Tim, here's Ben's score on this test, right? So now the information that I might have been afraid of revealing by the act of asking is actually not private anymore because the experimenters have just shared it. And so to that extent, my reputation in the small way is already hurt already, whether I ask or not. And we actually find that people still are deterred from asking. People still go less even then. And that shows that shame really does play a role where there's no theoretical room for signaling to be a part of it.
So, Ben, tell me, in this experiment, in this research, what did you actually do with the villagers?
We came to the village and we said, today we're going to play a guessing game. You will have the opportunity to make money by guessing basically which of two boxes there's a prize. So it's like a game show that we offered the villagers. And it was a fairly easy experiment to do because people, you know, like all of us, like the opportunity to play a game where they win money. But the key thing was that they were going to earn clues a little bit, again, like on a game show, in order to make a better guess. And those clues were basically draws from a hat that told you with some probability what was the right box, but there could be error in that. It wasn't all a perfect clue, but it was informative. And so the trick was that in some of our treatments, you would earn clues by doing better on a kind of intelligence test, you know, a rudimentary standardized test. And in other contexts, you would, in other treatments, your clues would just be random. And that was the main tool we were able to use to see how much people's willingness to go out and ask for more clues from friends depended on, you know, whether they were missing clues because they did badly on a test or whether they were missing clues just based on dumb luck.
Okay, so in this research that you did, how big do you find the overall stigma effect to be?
Yeah, the overall effect is we look at how often do people go and ask questions. And we find that putting signaling and shame together, they go and ask questions about half as often as they would if this was a topic where ability was not implicated at all. And so because the ultimately doing well in our experiment means possibly earning up to a day's wage, and people really seemed excited about that possibility, we do feel like it's evidence that bringing ability into the picture, whether through signaling or shame, can really, you know, as a rough first quantification, a 50% reduction in willingness to seek information in our context.
Okay, and to be clear, how big is the inhibition in this case that's based on shame and compare that to signaling?
We actually see a reduction of about the whole magnitude. So actually, when we focus on the cases where shame can play a role and signaling cannot, we see a reduction of 65% in seeking. So more than the total, if you'd like. Now, of course, that's only a small share of the situations. That's why for those shame cases, they're actually deterred 65%. The rest of the time, they're deterred somewhat less. But our takeaway is when shame plays a role, it can play a role every bit as big as signaling, which is kind of the more traditional instrumental or strategic channel that economists would have been thinking about in the past.
And I assume from our discussion earlier that this can vary depending on who exactly you are communicating with, asking for advice.
Absolutely. my co-authors Chandrasekhar and He Yang and I were interested in social networks. And one of the things I'm most excited about is cutting those effects by social relationships. So when we do that more detailed estimation, we find that shame does most of the deterring with friends and within one's own caste. And signaling plays a much bigger role in arm's length interactions where we put together people who didn't know each other well or perhaps even at all before our experiment. Now, a subtlety here is that even though we may spend most of our time with our close people, with where shame is the main effect, a lot of the valuable information flow across society, and this has been known in social networks literature for 40 years or more, comes from those relationships that aren't so close, where someone knows a new technique or knows a new opportunity. And we find that in those arm's length, socially distant relationships, signaling is actually, in our estimates, playing most of the role.
Now, I can understand the consequences for the villagers of this, because they're not getting the information they need on those dimensions that we discussed earlier. But there must be consequences, too, for policymakers from the stigma effect, because often this is how policy in these contexts is passed on, isn't it?
The larger stakes of this are that policymakers have a variety of tools at their disposal to get information out. And there's evidence that when people can engage socially and discuss especially complicated issues in their immediate communities and get feedback from smart friends, that really helps social learning a lot. But now our work highlights that the policymaker faces this trade-off. When you create learning opportunities that are inherently social, they're going to be tied to these reputational and shame concerns. And that's kind of inevitable. And so that creates a new consideration, a new trade-off in designing policies. For example, when you're thinking about, are you going to try to spread the word by some kind of socially embedded mechanism, or are you just going to go for a more traditional radio broadcast or something of that form?
Okay, so if you have social learning as part of your policy prescription, then what's a good idea? How can you maximize your impact? How can you minimize, I suppose, the impact of the social stigma that we have here?
This is really the high stakes question that we think is very important for the literature to understand better. Our own research stops short of saying much about it, and we really are engaging at this point in educated speculation. But I think there are things that I've learned from other people's work. So there's a paper that I very much like by Cole and Fernando, which develops basically a hotline service, which offers a remote consulting service for people to ask their farming questions. And the idea here is that if people are fine hearing about new ideas and maybe even talking to some extent with friends, but they don't want to ask all of their questions, there's a way for them to actually have expert advisors in the background that they can just call for free. Now, of course, maintaining those and making them work and making them accessible to people is not easy and maybe not even necessarily scalable. And there's one last thing that I want to mention, which is a beautiful paper by my Harvard Business School colleague, Chris Stanton, and co-authors. And it's called Workplace Knowledge Flows. It was recently published. And what they did is they created a situation where people were just encouraged to have lunch. This was in a US workplace, encouraged to have lunch and talk about their work process for a certain thing. These were sales agents. And it turned out to have huge effects on performance because there was a kind of permission given. Rather than my coming to you out of the blue and asking a naive question, there was a sanctioned context in which that interaction was, we were going to talk anyway, and people could really sort of, essentially by someone giving permission for that conversation to happen and in a sense facilitating it, breaking the ice, there was a lot that would have been stigmatized in maybe the normal course of things that became suddenly up for discussion and actually led to big improvements in performance. And so I'm hopeful, while we don't know all the ways that we could improve these things, I think there's really great evidence starting to come out that taking these things seriously can actually lead to real improvements in people's economic lives.
Ben, that's very interesting. This looks like a very fruitful area for future research, doesn't it? So thank you very much for talking about it today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much, Tim.
The paper we've been talking about is called Signaling, Shame and Silence in Social Learning, and it's a working paper. The most recent version you'll find was published in 2019. The authors are Arun Chandrasekhar, Benjamin Golub and He Yang. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. If you enjoyed it, subscribe on your podcast platform. That means you never miss an episode. And if you did miss an episode, well, you can find them all at voxdev.org.